Okay. It's the big topic everyone's been waiting for. Life after death. Actually, in order to understand the idea of life after death, first we have to understand what life is, and we have to understand what death is. First we'll start with death. There's three kinds of death within the Buddhist teaching, the Dhamma. The first is conventional death, or you might say physical death. That means of this body. That's what most people refer to when you speak about death. They refer to the death of the physical body. Well, death has a cause. And what's that cause? I mentioned it before. Birth. So birth is the cause of death. Then you have to ask yourself, what is birth? Because if you understand what death is, you have to understand how death was caused and what caused that. So, teaching we've already been discussing in the previous Kamma, that the reason this body was born is because, of course, it was because of the mother and father, for one reason. Had little fun and games in the bed, or wherever it was, in the back of the car, or whatever. But anyway, but, you know, according to science, that's all there is to birth. But according to the Buddhist teaching, there's a third factor needed. And that is a consciousness coming from some past existence. So in the Buddhist teaching, in the technical terms, Pali terms called Gandhava. It means it's a consciousness, a karmic energized consciousness coming from some other realm that somehow by some magnetic force is pulled or attracted into that fetus at the time of conception. And it's because of that consciousness that the fetus is developed. Now a miscarriage is when the consciousness doesn't lodge into the fetus or cannot stay in the fetus and it flies the coop. And so the fetus cannot develop without that consciousness. And this is the difference between medical science and the Buddhist Eastern kind of teachings about the reason. Whether you believe in that or not, it's, you know, up to you. I'm just explaining the traditional Buddhist idea about it. So this Gandhava carries with it that karma had been accumulated in the previous life of that person. So we can speak about the death. When the death occurs of the physical body, that means the body can no longer support consciousness. Consciousness has to have a viable kind of body in order to survive. So from whatever cause, accident, heart attack, breath stops, heart stops beating, the brain dies, the mind has to exit. And so it is attracted, according to the karma of that particular life, the strongest memories. If that mind still has, the person hasn't attained enlightenment, hasn't attained liberation. Their mind is still dominated by greed, hatred, and ignorance. But depending on how far that person has progressed on the path, they'll have more or less of greed, hatred, and ignorance. But let's just so the mind is like the memories in the mind of a certain situation depending on the person's order, person for self-centeredness, all kind of bad habits. That mind, you could say, is magnetized in this kind of a vibration. And so, when the mind dies, but it's attracted like a magnet. Mysterious how. Is attracted like a magnet. And feelings can continue on to exhibit themselves. And so, in which what's going on in the life. It's not and so whatever are somehow put away, this consciousness says that's where I need to be. Whether it's the experience, environment where it can continue spiritual growth or whatever. But anyway, that's a difficult part to understand, but it's attracted to that. And then it starts growing up, and then whatever accumulated greed, hatred, and delusion, so on are there, they will somehow, they may manifest in that life to cause that person to do what they do. They brought with them from the past. That's unique. And even with twins, there may be two different minds in those. Life takes different directions also. Or even within one family, one person might become a monk, might become some reason they're totally in different directions. Not the meaning, but law of karma makes perfect sense when you kind of think about it in those ways. But anyway, whether you believe that or not, general situation. So, and then that process of life. That person grows up, does all kinds of karma, learns things, does things, or whatever. Or maybe they start getting interested in spiritual things, and they might start meditating, might start cleaning up their karma, and start leading a good life. And then when they die, if they haven't attained enlightenment, then now, in more, contact with that in this next life. Let's But if a person lives like an animal in this life, let's say just like killing life and people, then they're better off having a tiger. They don't get put in jail. Dog doesn't get put in jail. The dog might be put to death. Animals can raping animals, doing their thing, killing. But as a human being, we do that, we get put in jail. So there's a body. Again, that's just a very strong. Doesn't have much greed and attachment like that. Then they might not be human, they might be a divine realm where they can experience that kind of pleasure. But the ordinary person who has human realm and perhaps isn't bad, the ordinary person, can be reborn again as a human. But anyway, this process goes on. Then you live another life, and whatever you do in that life kind of changes the quality of that mind, and at the time of death again, it goes on again. And it'll go on that way indefinitely. So the life after death, in that sense, of the physical death, it's going to be determined on how you've lived the life, what sort of wisdom or delusion, what's the strength of your greed, hatred, and delusion. What are the strongest types of memories? If you've done some very heinous type of crimes, like killing your mother or father or some other very heinous kind of things, then the consequences are going to be dire, according to the law of cause and effect. If you haven't done anything extremely bad, or maybe you've done something but you repented your ways and you turned a new leaf and all that, then again, you can't predict that. These are just kind of some speculation. But so as most of you know, the goal and the ultimate goal in the Buddhist practice is to attain liberation from what are called the realms of birth and death. So the process of the mind being reborn over and over and over again because of the accumulated greed, hatred, and delusion. This is called samsara. The actual word samsara means perpetual wandering. That means the mind is wandering through existence after existence. Sometimes it's a human, sometimes it's an animal, sometimes it's a divine being, sometimes in hell, sometimes it's a ghost. Within the Buddhist cosmology, there's 31, or however you, what the perspective is, 7, 6, 31, whatever, planes of existence, where the mind could be reborn, but it's reborn according to those types of propensities. Until finally one embarks on the spiritual path and purifies the mind of greed, hatred, and delusion. And then there's no more, and especially the ego overcomes the ego. And so there's no more, at the time of death, there's no more fuel for the consciousness. The consciousness is powered by fuel. This is your car powered by gasoline, right? You put gasoline in the tank and it keeps on going. So we keep creating karma. Karma is the gasoline. It means that because karma is created by the desire and ignorance, as long as we have that, we create the karma. We keep on putting gasoline into the tank. And so it keeps on going. But when we stop putting the gasoline into the tank, by purifying the mind of greed, hatred, and delusion, and then that individualized consciousness stops. And there's no more creation of a next life. Anyway, that's the standard explanation of this conventional rebirth. Now, there's another kind of death that I mentioned. I was going to talk about three kinds of death. The one is the physical death. The other is mental death. And this is what's occurring, or the death of consciousness, from moment to moment. And also how everything that's born dies. And this is referring also to mental states and our consciousness. That a person might be, you know, full of anger. And then maybe after some training, they're able to purify that anger, purify other negative mental state. So those mental states die, because everything is created by a cause, and the cause is removed, the death occurs, even to the mind and mental state, but especially of consciousness. Consciousness also isn't a static thing. In the Buddhist psychology, the mind is comprised of mind moments. That means the conscious mind. It's driven by the ego. In other words, right now you're all kind of looking up here. You look around, you see the monk, you see the Buddha statue, you kind of look around, you see all these different things, right? But it looks like a smooth flowing picture, right? And you think, I am the one that's seeing, and thinking about what I'm seeing. But according to the Buddhist psychology, the mind is made up of mind moments. It means moments of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking. Each of these moments arises in a moment and vanishes very quickly. And he said that that occurs a billion times in the finger snap. So we don't see it. It's doing that faster than a computer is processing information. The mind is working faster than that, even the human mind. And so each of those mind moments of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking are occurring alternately, randomly, but giving rise to this feeling of a kind of somehow a real world out there, or a concrete world. And the sense of I is behind it. The sense of I appears to be something that's illegal. But that's created by illusion, because we don't see the arising and vanishing. It appears to be something smooth and solid. Now, it's very similar to a motion picture reel of film, the old films, which were made up of individual frames. They don't have anymore. They're all digital now. example is not so clear. But I think you all know that. So the old films were made up of individual frames with a little space between it, right? They had these big reels of film they take down on the movie house. They put it on a projector. And they run the film through the projector with light. And the film is going fast enough that you don't see the spaces in between the frames. And then you see the movie on the wall. Nice, you know, smooth flowing scene. And, you know, you're rooting for the cowboys and the Indians or whatever, a steamy sex scene and getting all excited about it. But it's an illusion. Is everybody on the same page? You understand it? It's an illusion. So, in a similar kind of way, this world that we're seeing is like that. The mind is making this projection, the continual movie being projected out of the eyes. But the important thing is, if the sense of I appears to be real, because that sense of I appears with each of those moments of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, touching, and thinking, there's this idea that I am doing it. But that I is there because of ignorance, and because of clinging, and because of, you know, it all being run together, this illusion of some kind of a solid, permanent self. Or I is there in the mind. So anyway, birth and death on what we call the microscopic level is the birth and death of the consciousness from moment to moment. Or the birth and death of the mind from moment to moment, as they arise and vanish, depending on the condition. Or another analogy is of the animated film. You know, the cartoon artist who draws hundreds and thousands of pictures, each with a slight different movement, and they flash through, they're moving. And if you run that film on a slow motion projector, you can see the kind of spaces in between. How many of you remember going to the movies back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, and they used to run intermissions of those newsreels, and you could see the kind of the flickering of the film because they were running it on slow motion and so on. So that is actually what's occurring in the mind, but at a very fast rate to produce the self becomes something real. But that's called birth and death of the mind, or the first birth and death I mentioned of the physical body is what I call macrocosmic birth and death, or external birth and death, or physical birth and death. But the mental birth and death we call microcosmic birth and death, or internal birth and death, or mental birth and death. And that's the real birth and death. Not the ultimately real one. I'm going to talk about another one. But from the Buddhist psychological point of view, that is really what birth and death is. And our life now is simply a continuation of that. Because when a person dies, the whole life, the mind is going through momentary birth and death. And when he dies, it's simply the mind dies in that moment and arises in the next moment in another existence. If they're born as a deva, they're spontaneously born into a mind of light and so on, or a deva kind of mind made, a deva body, and so on. And they still have memory and so on. Or it plunges into the womb and goes into a dark state for 9 months and pops out, and bam, here I am again. takes off from there. So anyway, so the momentary birth and death is going on, and the body is just, you know, it's just a vehicle for momentary birth and death to occur. And so death really is just like changing clothes. You leave one body, you get another one. Whether it's a deva body, animal body, human body, wherever it is, you may be born, the body will go, and so on, according to the compass. But the momentary birth and death, that is what actually is the object of Vipassana meditation. Vipassana meditation means seeing reality divided up. The word vipassana is made up of two words, passana, which means seeing, and vi is a prefix, it means to divide things up into the parts, or seeing in a special way. And so vipassana meditation, as I was kind of encouraging you to try to do it in the last meditation where I said, you know, try to feel things coming and going, right? And you tune in to various sensations and sounds and thoughts coming and going, and if you're able to do that and have really good concentration, you can almost see that occurring in the mind. Just things are rising and vanishing so quickly, but the mind is not holding on. And when the mind doesn't hold on, the reality of things starts to disappear. Because the reality is only created through clinging, through greed, in attachment, in ignorance. We're clinging to all these things, so they appear real. And the ego exists because of desire. Ego and desire are like two sides of a coin. You can't have one without the other. And that's why people always want to be busy. They have to have something to desire. Because the moment you stop desiring, the ego starts disappearing. Because it was never anything solid in the first place. It was an illusion. Created by clinging. By ignorance and clinging. I know it's hard to understand, and that's why understand. But it's a very important understanding of the Dhamma, because it's really the essence of the nature of what causes suffering, and also what causes birth and death. So anyway, in Vipassana, we tune into that arising and vanishing moment to moment. And when the mind is no longer clinging to things because they're arising and vanishing so quickly, just like the motion picture reel of film, or let's say a better example of this, like a train. You go down the train tracks, and a train is going by slowly, and you're watching the gate. Train is going slowly, you can see each car, right? You can see the little coupling between each train car. Because it's going slowly. What happens when it speeds up? It speeds up very quick. Huh? What happens? You don't see the spaces in between the cars anymore. And it's just a blur. A solid kind of blur that goes by. So the same way, when we stop clinging, we don't see the individual cars anymore. That means the individual objects that we're looking at. Oh, that's a pillow, that's a person. They disappear. And there's only awareness. And so by developing, that's why Vipassana meditation is called, the seeing reality as it is, and it's the kind of meditation that leads to enlightenment. Because by doing that, and the sense of I also disappears. Because when the objects of the clinging disappear, the sense of I disappears. Because I mentioned the I is dependent on the object. We exist in relationship to the object that we either crave or hate. And when that is let go, there's no more food for the ego, the individual, consciousness, then it starts to disappear. But there's still awareness, and you're still alive. But you experience a whole kind of transcendent experience, or the mind is shifted over into the higher vibration of awareness, and is not trapped into the lower kind of ego-bound consciousness. And that is liberation. Of course, it occurs in gradual stages for most people. But anyway, so that life after death, of course, with each moment of death, you know, the mind arises again. But when you're floating, when you're the mind has entered the flow of awareness, and you're grounded in the present moment, and the mind is no longer grasping, then the awareness becomes expanded and is just floating with whatever is flowing through it without any type of grasping or clinging and any type of stress or anxiety and no suffering. And so life is elevated into a higher vibration. In other words, the mind is elevated into a higher vibration. And death occurs of all your old negative mind states and other sorts of things. They no longer arise anymore. But ultimately, ultimate death is ego death. And so we mentioned there's physical death, there's even mental death, but most importantly, ego death. And that is only achieved, of course, in full enlightenment. People like the Buddha and other arahant saints who attain enlightenment. That means the sense of self has been eliminated, transcended from the mind, and no longer arises, the sense of self, or any idea of I, me, and mine. And along with it, so does all desire and aversion and all kinds of mental states. And that's why that's the fuel, you know, the ego and desire is the fuel for the consciousness. So when a person attains enlightenment, that there's no more fuel for the mind to be reborn. So when that last body dies, there's no way to explain what happens after that death. Because the person actually functionally is already dead. So an arahant, or somebody who has attained enlightenment, total purification in the mind, basically has died before the physical body. Because life is really this ego-driven consciousness. At least the consciousness is driven by desire. So the ego death is the ultimate goal of meditation, because the ego is considered synonymous with suffering. As long as you're dominated by the thoughts of I, me, and mine, you'll be trapped within desire and aversion. Because if you start giving up desire, it's like committing suicide. And that's why people always want to be busy. The more busy you are, the more real you feel. So if you're clinging to that and believe that this ego is something real and you want to exist forever, then you'll never be able to give up desire. And that's why belief in the self is considered to be an impediment to at least to Buddhist meditation, an impediment to attaining liberation. Because as long as you believe and cling to this idea of I, then you have to go on desiring it. Because the moment you stop desiring, the I will start disappearing and you'll get afraid. And so many people report this in meditation. They'd like their mind to be calm. They have this fantasy, oh, if I could just attain, my mind would become blank and become free of thoughts. And I would, experience emptiness. They'd like to do that. Intellectually, it sounds nice. But when they actually, it comes to it, and they get to that point where the mind starts getting quiet, and it feels like they're being sucked down a black hole, they get afraid. Not intellectually, but unconsciously, the body contracts and fear arises. Because it's the fear of death. Even unconsciously. You might not be afraid of death, let's say, intellectually, but if you haven't trained yourself, your cells still are afraid of death. And they'll contract when something occurs. And so, but, that's why the intellectual wisdom is important, the right understanding. When you understand that this self is an illusion and how it arises, then when it starts to occur, you can enjoy it. You say, bye-bye. And let it go. And enjoy the bliss of being liberated from the I. So, that ego death is the ultimate death. Because with that death, there's no more rebirth. So the Buddha actually died before he died. That's why when they talk about the Buddha passing away, they say he attained parinibbana. They don't say the Buddha died. Death is not appropriate description for the death of an enlightened person. They attained parinibbana. That means the consciousness was released back into the whole of the cosmos, or whatever you might want to believe about it. It no longer exists. It's a separate entity. But death, whenever there's death, there'll be birth again. Because birth and death are just two dualities. Whenever there's birth, there'll be death, and whenever there's death, there'll be birth. Because we're talking about the ego death and the death of the mind, the death of greed, hatred, and delusion. But if they're still strong, they're still being born again and again and again, then they'll go on producing birth and death. And so life after death, whatever life you're going to have after death is going to depend on how you live your life now. And that's a good signboard. And at the time of death, somebody wanted me to specifically mention this, that the time of death is considered to be the most important time of your whole life. The last moment before death is the most important time of your whole life. That's because it said the last thought in the mind before you die determines where that consciousness will be attracted to. So if the mind is full of fear, if fear is the last thought before the death, it may be attracted to a place where you'll be able to experience lots of fear, like an animal. The jungle always fearing for its life. Or if you're born as a human being, some kind of human being is totally obsessed by fear. There are people like that. Or obsessed by greed, obsessed by lust, whatever sort of obsessions that you have when you die, then that may be an indication, because it's not absolutely that way. There's lots of variable factors, but the mind will be seeking those out. That's why it's very important to train yourself to free the mind, to overcome all these kind of neurotic obsessions, negative thoughts, other types of things that may play a role when you die, to cause further, you know, your next life to also become full of problems and suffering. So you could say that the whole practice of the Dhamma is the practice for death. That we're preparing for death. Because we don't know. Death can happen at any time. Didn't it? Already mentioned that. Anytime, any place, anything could kill us. With this body of death. So we can't wait around. Right? And that's why the insistence in the Buddhist teaching, you can't wait around and say, well, I'll practice later. Because there may not be a later. There'll be a later, but it may not be what you want. In fact, there's a nice little saying by a Tibetan Lama said that the tomorrow or the next life, we don't know which will come first. We may think, oh, tomorrow I'm going to go to the beach, do this and that. We may die in our sleep. We may get murdered. We may die in an accident. And the next life will come before tomorrow. There's no guarantee. Like, death is the only thing certain in the life. Life is not certain. Death is certain. And there's a little analogy that life is a sexually transmitted disease and it's always fatal. People don't know, like to hear that. So, you know, what all this boils down to is the whole reason why we, at least the main reason why one we meditate is that when we die, we'll be able to die with a peace of mind and we won't have any regrets. We won't have any unfinished business that may pull us back to another life in order to finish the business. That's why especially forgiving people that have hurt you. If you're holding somebody out of your heart, holding grudges, not forgiving them, you're going to meet them in another life. Unless they attain enlightenment before you, you'll meet them in another life. And that's why there's so many families and people that have been reborn many times in the same families, quarreling, arguing, having all kinds of problems, and not, maybe not even family, but friends, this and that. You're going to meet up in a future life in order to finish a business. In these stories, there's many hundreds and thousands of stories in the Buddhist texts that illustrate this in the Buddha's own life, in other people's lives, and whether you believe that or not, you know, that's your business, but these examples and stories are there. But the whole point is that when we die, you know, without any grasping and clinging or fear or any negative state, so we can die peacefully and hopefully our future life, whatever it will be one with more light and be able to carry on our spiritual evolution without being dragged back into all of these sort of lower type of suffering type of existence and so on. So, you know, that's another meaning of the, you know, the life after death. It's basically what you plan. So you're planning now for your next life by living your life. So the more you meditate, the more you have Dhamma in your mind at the time of death, the Dhamma or scenes of meditation or whatever it might be into your mind, and you'll be attracted to a place where you'll contact the Dhamma probably very quickly or easily in the next life, and be able to continue your progress toward liberation. But if you do lots of things and have lots of greed and craving, then those kind of thoughts may come up in your mind, and you know, that's what ghosts are. Ghosts, according to Buddhist kind of cosmological explanation, a ghost is somebody who had strong craving for the house, or strong craving, desires for, you know, things of this earth, but especially that. So if they're reborn in the house, they can't let it go. They don't know they're dead. But they don't have a physical body anymore. They have a ghost type of body, which is just a mind-made type of body. You've seen the movie, right? But they might be real. I mean, Buddhists believe that those kind of ghosts are real. So, but this kind of a person, they suffer. Because they see you, they see their family enjoying, you know, Thanksgiving dinners, and they're craving that taste, but they don't have a body to enjoy it, so they suffer. That's why they're called hungry ghosts. And that's the name given in the Buddhist, Theravada Buddhist text, called a hungry ghost. That means they're hungry, they have lots of craving, but they can't satisfy it because they only have a mind-made body, and they're in no position to enjoy what they can see. But they can see the things. They can't enjoy it. That's why they suffer. Or they see their loved one, and they want to touch them, hold them, but they can't. And their loved one is running away. Oh, there's a ghost in the house, there's a ghost in the house. Well, that was Uncle Joe. But we don't know that. I mean, again, this is kind of a little funny speculation, but could be true. So the whole point is to purify the mind of these kind of things that may lead to, and not only about the next life. Practicing meditation is going to, however long that you may live again in this life, or another 20, 30, 40 years, even the meditation you do now is going to make that last years, whatever they are, more peaceful and less suffering. And then when you die, that will simply be carried over again. But we should really see this idea of death as being ego death. And not to be afraid of death. The only reason to be afraid of physical death is if your mind is still polluted by greed, hatred, and delusion, and guilt, worry, remorse, and fear. Then you have something to fear because you won't be able to control your mind when you die. It's like a crapshoot. You know, it's going to be drawn like a magnetic force to wherever it needs to go in order to experience the result of one thought and action. And I'll just finish this talk by a little kind of contemporary example that I've been using to try to explain this to Westerners. The example of a cell phone. So people say, how does the karma know where it should be reborn? How does a person know where it should be reborn? How does the karma? There's no ego or I. How, you know, how does the mind know where it should be reborn? So, just take the example of a cell phone. You have a cell phone, and you punch in 8 or 10 numbers, calling somebody over halfway around the world, in India, Sri Lanka. And within 5 seconds, some invisible energy, you can't even see it. Now the cell phones don't even have antennas. Maybe you're even in a concrete room. And you punch those numbers in, and it finds that cell phone halfway around the world out of a crowd of 1 million people, somehow finds it that quick. To me, that's a miracle. To me, that's harder to understand than rebirth. How that happens. Rebirth is a piece of cake. So, you know, how does that invisible energy that doesn't have an ego or an I in it find that particular, so, so the idea of how does a mind that's magnified with greed, hatred, and delusion and memories find a place that's going to fit that? It's not hard to understand. But it's funny, that the very people who invented the cell phone probably don't believe in greed, but I can't understand it. But anyway, so that's sort of an analogy of how it works. And, you know, here we have area code, right? You have an area code, and then you have your personal number. So the area code is the plane of existence where you be reborn, like the area code for human beings. HB303. And then there's the animal world. There's the area code of the animal world, the area code of the Devaloka, area code of hell, area code of the hungry god. And so the general vibration of the mind sends you to that particular area code. And then the individual number is your individual karmic number that selects the individual body or mother and father or family you're going to be reborn. Anyway, that's just a funny little example I just made up, but yeah. Anyway, it's interesting. So anyway, I think that may be enough for this talk on that subject. And if you do that and have any last questions about that, then I'll try to clear it up.
Bodhisattva. Does that mean that an enlightened person can come back and teach on this plane?
Well, I'll try to answer those. Those are difficult questions. But first of all, in the Buddhist psychology, there's no such thing as a soul. So the Buddha doesn't believe that people have an individual soul. They talk about the consciousness. Now you can call the consciousness the soul, and that's probably what people mean when they say soul. They mean the consciousness. That means their individual identity, that's their soul. And so that's what they believe is going to exist forever in some heaven or hell or wherever they think, or believe. And so that's what most people identify as their soul, at least from the Christian point of view, when I've understood. And we've just mentioned that this idea of I is an illusion. So people that believe in the soul are simply are people who haven't experienced the transcendence of ego delusion. And so they think it's something from it. But the Buddha was able to train his mind and totally eliminate it, but still had awareness. He didn't die. And he could still speak and walk all over India and preach 100,000 discourses, but without a sense of I. But it's the I, along with its greed and craving, which is the fuel for the rebirth. So therefore, when that greed and craving stops, the consciousness, it just evaporates. Because it just loses it like a car running out of gas. And it ceases to exist, it doesn't create any more existence. And you can't say, where did it go? We take this example. You have a jar of water with a lid on it. The jar is floating in a lake. So the water in the jar, let's say that's your individual mind. The water in the lake is the world, everybody else. And the glass jar and the lid is your body. So when the mind of, let's say, an enlightened person dies, like the jar is open, and the mind or the awareness doesn't go into another jar. It just goes into the ocean. And can you say, where did my mind go? There's my consciousness, there's my consciousness. But you can't say it ceased to exist either, can you? There's no way to describe it. So that's probably the closest little analogy of what may happen to the mind. After. It's not annihilation. The ocean is still there. It's become part of the ocean. So people who accuse Buddhists of being annihilationists, they don't have any foundation. Even people accuse the Buddha of being annihilationist. He says, okay, in one way I teach annihilation. I teach annihilation of greed, hatred, and ignorance. That's the only thing. That's the only thing that's annihilated is greed, hatred, and ignorance. Now, that answer your question?
Yeah, but what about
the... Yeah, the other one. Well, the bodhisattva is a term used in Tibetan Buddhism. And according to that, they don't want to attain nirvana, final nirvana. They want to keep being reborn to teach, like the Dalai Lama, for example. Now, they make that wish. So they still keep some desire in the mind, the desire to be reborn. They can still purify their mind of most other kind of defilement, but they keep that one wish in the mind. So that one wish is like the silver, the thread that will allow them to be reborn. But the arahant is somebody who doesn't care about that. They don't develop that wish necessarily, and so the mind is not reborn, and they attain complete nirvana. Now these terms, Nirodha, you mean, you're talking about Nirodha Samapatti?
I'm talking about Nirodha as the ninth level after the eighth jhanas, the four form and the four forms.
Okay, that's called Nirodha Samapatti in Pali language, Nirodha Samapatti. That refers to, actually, the Pali term, I better get Bhante to come help me with that. I'm not a Pali expert. But Sanya Veda Na Nirodha means the cessation of feeling and perception. That's the definition of Nirodha Samapatti. It's the cessation of feeling and perception. And that means you lose consciousness of this world. And there's no longer any consciousness of this world. There's no feeling of self, I, other. And it's said to be equivalent to nibbana after a person had died. But the person doesn't stay in that. That's a samadhi. They come out of it. But it is said that only an anagami can attain that state, but not less than an anagami, because they've already reached, they're almost in full enlightenment, not quite. But with the help of jhana, they can attain this Nirodha Samapatti, but they come out of it. And so it's not the same as nibbana, because there's still only an anagami. But when they attain that state, it is said that it's similar to the experience in nibbana after death, but for them, it's not permanent, they come out of it. But naturally, their mind still will be in a very, very expansive state. And I don't know what the Hindus call them. These terms are bantered around in various types of religion and philosophies, and sometimes we have different meanings, so it's quite confusing. It can be confusing. Even the term samadhi is confusing, because Hindus use the term samadhi in one way, and the Buddhists use it in a different way, in nirvana also. So you have to be clear about who you're talking to or what they mean by it before you can give a kind of a proper answer. Yeah, that's why Nirodha Samapatti is considered a jhana, a concentration, not the vipassana. And why you have to attain all eight of those other jhanas along with the stage of anagami to be able to attain the state. So it pertains to very, very few individuals. Probably maybe one individual on earth today would be able to attain that. I mean, that's just a speculation, but I'm saying that that's not a common thing, so it's not even worth talking about, actually.
Thanks for answering that question. Since that man interjected something, I wanted to say there is some confusion, but I think that there was a great Hindu saint who could have surgery. I can't remember his name, Rama Maharshi Ramakrishna, and he could go into some kind of absorption and not feel pain, but I don't think that's the same kind of experience myself personally.
No, it could be a person who can attain a higher level of jhana. They could not experience pain if something happened to them. I've even gone to the dentist and refused to take Novocaine for basic drilling and stuff like that, and just enjoyed feeling the pain shooting through the body that was kind of detached from it. So I think we'll bring this session to an end, and hope all of you maybe got some benefit from the series of talks and meditations, and hopefully you're able to use it for your furtherance of your own spiritual development, meditation practice.